Well, not always. In general, a performance posits a relationship between the performers and audience. But what are our ethical responsibilities to the audience, our partners in performance? And what constitutes harm to them? In a wide-ranging conversation, Alice Longley, Carol Brown, Louise Tu'u, Murray Edmund, Craig Cooper, Stephen Bain, Alison East, Brent Harris, Sally Barnett, True Paraha, Val Smith, Mark Jackson, David Cross, Sally Morgan, Mark Harvey, Moana Napier, Becca Wood, and Alexa Wilson explore questions of participation, advance information, offence, and physical and emotional risk in performance.
Well, there's the obvious way of thinking through that question, which is thinking about harm as being, emotional, physical damage. So, of course, you have a huge responsibility to your audience to ensure their safety.
Like any kind of human activity, there are risks and harm, but you mentioned specifically harm to the audience.
Yeah.
So there could be physical harm, there could be psychological harm, there could be causing distress, causing discomfort. But I kind of, it's interesting because discomfort I don't see as harmful in a way that physical harm could be. I would never, of course, want to harm an audience physically, but I would want them to feel uneasy, to create a sense of discomfort or disease, dis-ease.
You know, when I think about experimental work, you think about Artaud or some of the experimental theatre practitioners who felt that it was important to create psychological conditions that pushed people into thinking in new ways or breaking down boundaries. And those boundaries can be seen as safety boundaries, take you out of your comfort zone. I mean, for a lot of people, being taken out of their comfort zone is one of the reasons that they love performance.
Yeah.
So I guess there's a fine line there where what one person could consider a beautifully challenging comfort zone pushing work, another person could consider problematic.
Yeah.
There is no way of knowing what happens in that immediate event of live presence. There's no, and Bart talks about like that, the difference between watching a film and going into a live encounter is that I could reach out and touch you at any moment. There's always that risk of transgression. And whatever happens in that event, is where the unexpected will happen. Someone will come up and reach out and touch you, or in the middle of the event, there'll be a display of air force over the top, which completely changes the perception of what you're seeing, or a performer gets injured, and then it completely changes what you see, your perception of what you're seeing. I mean, and if you think of the Moscow theatre siege and what happened there, when there was that occupation of the theatre, that people thought it was a performance. They thought it was a performance. They didn't realise it was real life happening. Took over the stage.
Because
and
it was
guests,
within the
context
of
an opera where there's Jami generals and things. So there's all the, I just get, the point is that this we can never know. We can never safeguard against the unexpected. And you wouldn't want to in live performance. That is the beauty of it.
I think you have a responsibility to think, by the same token, with me saying, okay, I don't really know what the work is, I have an idea. I have an idea what potentially might harm the audiences. On the other hand, I think, Auckland audiences need some harm, because there's a lot of work out there that just tends to be harmful and no one's warned me. And I've gone to see and gone, oh my God, that was just, what was that, And it's, I suppose it's how you define harm. Like, is it harmful that we're still making French Pony up your asses kind of work, or, as one extreme example, or is it that we tend to make the same work over and over again? Is that harmful as well?
What harm does The Sound of Music do to every child? It's probably immeasurable,
I can sing at least three of those songs.
I know, you see. What does one mean? On the other hand, when I saw Los Furos del Bas in Barcelona, the Catalan company. I mean, I had my raincoat on, I needed it on, and I was actually quite scared because it was so dark and the music was so loud and people were skating around on large wheeled contraptions with hardly any clothes and sliding on the mud, and they didn't seem to care where we were. So I really, I was scared and I enjoyed it. And so I mean, they're extremities, aren't they?
Yeah.
Of terrorizing the audience.
It's interesting if we thought about the impact on a child, for instance. You know, that there might be an event, and you possibly remember yourself, that kind of stays almost like a memory scar, you know. And it might be, you know, my sister sitting under the seat at Wizard of Oz when we were 5 years old. You know, didn't want to see the Tin Man, completely frightened of the. You know, think of the Wizard of Oz.
I walked out of the Gremlins. I couldn't cope.
Yeah. So I mean, I think there's certain things that we welcome fear. I mean, it's like, you know, Grimm's fairy tale. I mean, we need to feel fear. We need to feel afraid. I actually really believe that we have these deep roots of a part of our humanity is to feel uneasy and discomfort, and that's actually something quite necessary. I don't think where would it cross in. I'm trying to think of an instant where it would cross into psychological harm.
Yeah, well, absolutely. You can certainly have material on stage that is quite upsetting or distressing for certain members, or maybe all members of the audience. But certainly, if you touch on some subjects, it might really hit on a raw nerve for a particular audience member.
Oh, well, the classic one is, you know, if you portray sexual violence on stage, you can't just go, wham, there it is, see you later. There is sort of some, we know from history that there are repercussions for bringing things up that people might have repressed. So you need to sort of think, well, how is this, how am I dealing with this socially, I guess.
From a producer point of view, and as I said earlier, that role that a producer provides in terms of connecting the artist to the audience, you know, your responsibility is for the performers and supporting them to do their work, but it's also to the audience and allowing them to make an informed choice about what they come and engage with. So really, I think there's a degree of responsibility around informing audiences ahead of time if you think that there could be something. And I mean, there's some quite basic things that we already do, like, you know, if there's going to be nudity or if there's going to be strong language or sometimes, I guess, there might be a mention of a particular theme that is in a work that might not be immediately obvious from an image or a story title or whatever. I think going back to what you're saying about the ethics, I think there's an ethical responsibility as a producer to inform audiences to an extent of the kind of thing that is going to be confronting them in the piece. Yeah, I do think that's important. Having said that, you know, you don't want to, just from a narrative point of view, you don't want to give away the story, you know, the classic spoiler alert. You don't want to give away the story, or the particularly if you have a piece where you might not know what the you know, it's the big reveal, if you like. So a good example of that actually is, spoiler alert here, if you haven't seen When the Rain Stops Falling, which I think is one of the most extraordinary plays of the last 10 years, really. It's just a beautiful, amazing work of theatre. I've seen two productions of it, and Silo Theatre Company did one here in Auckland. That's a play that actually, one of its main themes is the theme of child abuse and how it sort of manifests through generations. But that term's never used in the play. It's not, and to actually say that's what the play is about is really trivializing actually the breadth of all the different themes that are there. But it is a really core part of it, and it's quite a disturbing part of it, and it's revealed only sort of midway through. You have no idea that that's, you know, what part of the play is about.
Yeah.
So there's an ethical challenge there, and you can't give that away. So I guess there were people in the audience watching that play who would be taken aback and might be, you know, for various reasons, may struggle with that, to be have that suddenly thrust upon them.
Yeah.
But I guess...
It's sort of like balancing the needs here, isn't it?
Yeah.
And actually evaluating what kind of degree of harm.
Yeah, yeah. And also I think there's also, you know, you've got to look at it in the context of the whole piece, because it's not like it's just going, oh, by the way, we're going to throw in a, you know, an incident of child abuse here, and isn't it disturbing, and then we're on to something else. You know, it actually, as I mentioned, it really is a play that examines the whole reverberations through generations. And for me, it was a take on that theme that I hadn't seen before, in the way it really stretched across, I think it stretched across 4 or 5 generations, reverberating from that incident. So by the time it obviously got to the fifth generation, the actual incident itself was no longer the key interest. It was more about just how this dysfunctional family had fallen apart, if you like. So yeah, I think in terms of the way it treated the issue, which is a disturbing issue, it really did bring something to that issue and allow you to see it in a different way. And I would imagine for many people it was a really positive outcome once they left the theatre, but still harrowing. Yeah, but that's what theatre does, you know. It takes you on journeys that you might not know, well, you might not want to go on initially, but I guess great works actually deliver you to somewhere that's a better place.
Like, if the work is something, you know, profoundly challenging, I'm thinking about like Shopping and Fucking by Mike Ravenhill or something like that, where there's issues around the rape of a young boy and his death and violence, and yeah, do you need to flag all of that material up? But a lot of audiences who chose to go to see a work called Shopping and Fucking probably have an awareness of what they're going to see and why before they go there. Like, that work is, you know, I mean, it was quite relatively mainstream, but people went to it because of the rawness of the material. Yeah. And at what point does the audience say, oh, I'm really uncomfortable with this, I'm leaving? And I'm thinking, if I was, you know, maybe... because that show generally is done in quite a black boxy kind of way. There's quite a clear separation between the audience who are watching quite relatively passively, and then the performance, that people could just go, oh, this is disgusts me, I'm just looking out. And where is the psychological damage? I mean, unless you had experienced that material in your own life and you had a, you know, I'm just not sure.
Well, once again, the audience has the right to walk out if they don't approve of what's happening. I'm thinking of Douglas's Wright's Black Milk at the moment, and how a lot of people in the audience felt dreadfully uncomfortable about the kinds of thematic content that he was projecting onto the audience or making the audience watch. But once again, the audience could get up and walk out, and many of them did. And if you chose to stay, I suppose you were agreeing to be the viewer of this kind of work. You could critique it later and say, I think that's disgusting, but you sat there watching. So, but I mean, of course, you'd paid your big bucks, and should they charge that much for people to come and watch people doing compromising things to each other on stage? I don't know. Perhaps they feel that they have no power to leave.
You've always got the right to leave.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to stay. Somebody can't make you stay in the room with them. You can't be made to endure somebody's performance.
That is the difference.
Yet people still do stay because they feel, and I also wonder, I mean, that's socially constructed as well. They feel socially impolite to leave.
That's a culturally determined. Yeah. I think a lot of different cultures, people don't. We're doing a kind of, we're looking at, you know, when Nijinsky's Rite of Spring was performed in 100 years ago in May this year, April this year, you know, more than half the theatre walked out. And that is the classic, you know, modernist spectacle of the 20th century now. That piece, you know, people, it was a riot. It actually caused a riot in Paris. When you think of Meg Stewart, Damaged Goods, she's got a performance that she just... It doesn't end until the last person's left. So it plays on that boundary.
I think what I'm interested in that, in like relation to that issue, is that the way that an event kind of creates this situation where... I think Mark Harvey had a kind of thing... we talked about this idea of getting carried along or not getting carried along in this thing. I can't comment about what he says about it, but like... there's a context which carries me along, and I might say yes to something or I might not say no to something in this kind of charged situation, or, you know, if it's a... if it kind of pushes a little bit and then it goes, oh, it's a little bit more and a little bit more, and everyone's kind of in on this feeling, then it can have this sense of, like, a walk away later and go, oh, that was actually quite dangerous, or I think I should have actually not participated in that, so...
There's a difference between people who've paid to go and see something. They get a ticket, or they've gone to a gallery, or they know they're going into an art institution, and there are certain kinds of framing protocols around that that means that I'm up for something. I know that I'm going to go and see Raffaele Sanchio, and there'll be a man walking on stage, and there'll be fighter dogs attacking him. Yeah. And I know that he's done this before, so he's not going to die. I know that I go and see Alain Platel's new piece, and he's going to have dogs on stage, a lot of them, including a young dog who's going to be spun on someone's bicycle helmet. People in the audience are going to get up and shout, that's abusive to those dogs.
Yeah, and obviously you have to be aware of that contextual information. Like Silo Theatre did it in the Herald Theatre. So, do you know already, if you're sort of informed a little bit about theatre, you kind of know the sort of work that Silo does, you kind of know the sort of work that goes on in the Herald, so... there's not many people that would have gone in there expecting, you know, The Lion King or, you know, The Wiggles, or, you know, it's pretty clear you're not going to get that kind of experience. But having said that, you wouldn't have necessarily known the details of what you were going to get.
When you're putting an audience into an environment where the material was very, really intense, quite disturbing at times and upsetting, how you manage that for the audience. And I think that's something as well that theatre, live performance, has a better ability to do that, because you've got real people performing in the room, you know. And it's very hard, for example, if you go to a film, you know, you can see something that's totally fucked up. But there doesn't seem to be any responsibility on the part of the cinema owner to make, I mean, they obviously have to put a rating and whatever, but to make that experience for the audience in any way a kind of a safe experience. So actually, you know, if you see a film that's about, you know, child abuse or whatever, I mean, I don't know of any kind of films really that I've been to where there's any sort of, you know, some of this stuff might be really challenging, and if you have issues with it, this is what you should do, or let's have a forum afterwards and talk about it, or let's, you know. And I think with live performance there's really good opportunity to do that, to have that dialogue with your audience and to get that immediate kind of feedback during or after the performance or whatever. And I think that's a really good way to create that safe kind of that safety for audiences around material. I mean, I think there's different levels of, you know, obviously if someone's putting on a fringe show, for example, then, you know, and they're charging $10, then there's a bit more sort of looseness around kind of you know, whatever goes, because the an audience would expect things to be a little more fringy, shall we say. So if I'm going to go to a fringe show, then I would expect it to be perhaps a little more out there, perhaps a little more pushing boundaries, perhaps a little bit kind of looser in terms of that stuff, because that's the context for that work. Whereas, for example, if you're pitching, you know, in the fringe audience, we do work at sort of the fringe level to prepare people for kind of a bit of a wild ride. Whereas, you know, for example, if you're going to an ATC theatre piece, then I would expect that, you know, they have really, really clear communication, which they do, you know, around the sort of content in their work.
There are times where I feel that it's entirely an audience's responsibility to, in terms of psychologically, to choose to engage and disengage and protect themselves from whatever they perceive to be harmful. So it's always this this tension between what you perceive could be considered harmful and what you, and not wanting to mollycoddle the audience either. Because, so, you know, it's that issue of what is offensive and what is material that could be considered, yeah, harmful in that way to a person's sensibility. Theatres always insist that you write down if there's, well, violence, of course, and or nudity, because to some person's sensibility, seeing nudity is harmful to them or perceived to be harmful, whereas I find that absurd. But I have to operate within those sorts of parameters sometimes as well. So what I consider to be harmful or possibly could interfere with someone's sense of harmony and beauty and what is right and correct is differs greatly from my own. Mm. And sometimes I will take those considerations. I will take those things into consideration. And sometimes I think, no, fuck you.
70s and 80s was very easy for us to perform nude a great deal. You know, I did performances in pubs where my body was completely painted with something. You know, I had some minimal amount of lower, you know, attire on, but often topless. I love the naked body in performance, and I wish that there was more of it. I can't see why we have to wear clothes all the time. But in terms of you know, the beauty of the physical body should be allowed to be. There's a whole lot of prudishness and American prudishness that's crept into performance that I, you know, perhaps I find that more unethical than anything. The unethics of ethics, of morality, of pseudo-morality or...
It's just questioning the whole ontology of it too. It's like, who decides that nudity is offensive, that it needs to actually even be written as a possible, as a disclaimer? Just as a concrete example, as a form of possible harm. Or you have to warn if it's got adult content so that people don't bring their kids. And I'm not quite sure what adult content is, whether it's in the theme or whether it just implies some sort of sexual... content.
That's why I usually end up doing independent things, because I really can't stand that thing where you're supposed to say if there's nudity or not, or you know, they're just the sort of guidelines that festivals sort of have, which to me kind of is unethical, because it's dictating to me how I want to frame the experience of the audience.
Yeah.
It was interesting when I worked in an education program in Wellington, at the Wellington Festival, and in the theatre in New Zealand, there isn't any kind of rating sort of system in terms of work. So you don't have an R18 theatre show necessarily, but you can certainly have, you know, full nudity, you can have, you know, sexual and drug references, you can have all of that sort of stuff. And so, for example, we had the show, the History Boys, which came to Wellington, fantastic piece of theatre. But we had a Catholic school, for example, who came to see the show, and most of the students were fine, I have to say, but there was one particular student who was very upset by the content, and she left the show and, you know, called her father, and then of course he came back to us to say, you know, this is why I put my child in a Catholic school, because they're raised to have Catholic views, and, you know, why is she, you know, then seeing, which obviously he took up with school and with us, but he was very, very unhappy, because obviously the History Boys has a lot of very kind of explicitly gay content and references, and also very explicit references really to kind of sexual harassment or abuse really of, you know, from the teacher to the students, and that's dealt with in a fairly matter of fact, sort of almost light hearted way, which I guess is something else that was of concern to them. But so certainly with young people, we very much had to look at the content of each of the shows, and again, it's about giving as many tools to the audience as you can. So, you know, talking to teachers, and we had a lot of teachers who called us to say, do you think, you know, this is going to be okay for my students, this is how old they are, and we would talk them through what's in the show and all of that sort of stuff. I think we do have a real responsibility to be open and honest.
So I think the first responsibility to your own audience is to understand its intelligence. And I think a lot, sometimes things go wrong because the intelligence of the audience is misunderstood, often underestimated. And I think one of the, you know, in terms of theatre anyway, the fatal thing about trying to confront the audience is that you underestimate the intelligence of the audience, who will very quickly sidestep you and come back with something much better, or ignore you, or simply be embarrassed, which is their right. You know, and in a funny sort of way, the audience is never wrong if you decide you can get up there and do that and they don't respond in the way you want.
There's something to be said about creating maybe context for audiences to talk about their responsibilities, and the kind of the effect that their views have on restricting the performance or restricting the experience of each other in the space. So it's like maybe putting the emphasis on back onto audiences, where spaces or contexts or conversations can enable them to look at different ways of viewing.
That we focus so much on the responsibility of the performer or the producer or the theatre, forget to think about the other side of the contract, so to speak, or the other side of the relationship.
Yeah, I find that interesting, thinking about that, because people just, I think there is a tendency of, you know, you just pay your ticket and you come, and then you sit down and that's it. But it seems more interesting to me to kind of think around, yeah, what are some possible ways that I can be in this space other than just passive observer, you know, getting into that more of like the active spectator and the agency of that spectator to read into the performance without being told what it is. Not educating, but like having these conversations where we can empower ourselves as audiences to be more intelligent about engaging with work.
So certainly the audiences quite easily fall into, I won't say there's a passivity, because there is an active agency. It's not a passivity with respect to what one is doing. There is an active agency to be audience, and which means there is an active agency not to be performing. And so it's always in a positivity. It's not a reticence, but an activity one is doing by not acting, if you like. And so certainly audiences are co-optable in that regard.
Well, I think audiences need to be educated too in how to respond to work. And I think that's... you know, about, I mean, I've sat in theatre or sat in through events so many times. I mean, it's the great thing about performance in an art gallery, often you can come and go, you know, it's different. Yeah. My first piece I did in an art gallery, Shelf Life, it was the whole thing. You stay as long as you like and you leave. But I would stay in the gallery, I'd stay on the shelf as long as I could. But I think, you know, people...
it's not just... comes up to this transaction again. And into some, you know, that we are, we become subjects through encounter. You know, we become through encounter. We're not freestanding individuals. We're actually relational beings. Yeah. The problem with the encounter is we've become so sort of constrained by certain codes of the frame that it can be hard for people to fear, to recognise their ethics.
The act of engaging in a performance as an audience member or a performer is quite a ritualistic activity, and we do have a series of kind of rituals that kind of endows the performance space with a kind of license to do things that otherwise shouldn't be done. I mean, you can have an actor naked on the stage, but if they were to step off the stage and walk into the foyer, we'd all be horrified. But if they're doing it on the stage, that's fine, because that's the space you can do it. So we allow a whole lot of things to happen there that we wouldn't otherwise allow to happen. So yeah, it is, it's interesting, but yeah, how far can you push those boundaries? That's the interesting one. I mean, I think the nudity is an interesting one, isn't it? Because if a person stood, you know, half a metre from you naked, you'd be kind of probably feeling slightly uncomfortable. Well, I mean, it would be inappropriate and you might feel violated or offended or whatever. Whereas that can happen frequently on stage. You can be sitting in the front row and you're having that experience, but somehow it's okay. Doesn't mean we don't feel disconcerted or you know, challenged, but we're not going to, you know, bring the police. Whereas you probably would if it happened in your living room.
Yeah.
It's my backyard. Not here. Yeah. It's that great thing, you know, that how far, what is it? When do togs become undies in the distance from the beach? You know, you can wear your undies at the beach, but how far away from the beach do they suddenly become undies again? And they become wrong?
The setting and the context. Well, I would say that, you know, the street is a context in itself. Like, people have understandings about what's okay and not okay in that kind of environment. But in terms of the theatre or a performance situation, people come with an understanding that, you know, boundaries are going to be pushed in some way, and that's a part of the experience.
Because the thing about performance, even in live art situations, and though it kind of disavows this, there is still a sort of sense of illusion. There is always some sense, but it's not real.
Yeah,
it's happening on stage.
It's this, where that is a barrier somehow.
And I think live art is, you know, contests that, you know, by creating real situations and you know, denying the stage in a way, and kind of, and situations where I'm working in sites like we are at the moment, Waterfront, where you're actually dealing with people's day-to-day lives. You're not expecting to see performance in the midst of their, you know, morning working routines. You know, you're defamiliarizing the familiar. And you have to, I mean, I do feel a huge ethical responsibility in that sense, that I don't want to, I'm careful not to trip people up physically to cause harm or to obstruct, you know, or to cause, it's interesting, you know, we hold up traffic, you know, stop the flow. I've got a beautiful photo of one of the performers, you know, with this big slow sign standing in the middle of the road in Perth saying slow, you know, making, changing. We do change, having said that, we do change the behaviour of the city through performance, and I'm interested in that. So that's an interesting issue, isn't it?
Yeah.
So that is disrupting. It's a real disruption, actually. The flow of people's lives. My belief is that that's not harmful, that's necessary.
I think that a prepared audience just has a greater sense of buy-in, that they've already established their level of engagement further than one that you need to draw in. But it's essentially the same thing. So I've got another performance where it's an installation in a public place, and people have to come to me. So their level of what they will engage emotionally or ethically into that thing is completely on their terms. So I think that's the only difference. Mm. Fundamentally, it's the same thing.
Yeah. Because there's no neutral work, and there's no general public. I mean, one of the great searches of the late 19th and 20th, most of the 20th century, and something I was involved in a little ways, was to find the, you know, the general public, to get to the ordinary person, you know. But my conclusion has been there isn't really an ordinary person, that all audiences are prepared. You know, they come to the occasion in one way or another prepared. I suppose the most unprepared is something like a spontaneous street performance. But even to that extent, that most of us are now prepared for a spontaneous street performance because we know what it is. We can choose to stay and watch or move away or whatever. But I think most audiences come with knowledge, intelligence, a wish to be there, and so on, you know. And that's part of the contract. But it is an elaborate shifting contract, yeah.
And when I'm doing something on the street or in a public place, in order for me to get the public to consider what I'm asking them to consider, I need to protect them from the possibility, from other possibilities, yeah, that they'd be humiliated or that they might get injured or that they might feel uncomfortable or all the things that actually block that, yeah, experience. It's all to do with what's actually am I trying to lead that public to. So my ethics are based on the principles of that specific performance. So in another state, I could very happily make the audience very uncomfortable. You know, it's not very hard to do that. You know, yeah, you stick people in a confined space, you make a loud noise with bright light, and that's great too, because you that's the parameters of that performance. And so for me, the ethics of are dependent on the situation, but the artistic argument.
You know, and to the other end, you know, I don't like going to shows where, even for example, you know, if something's going to be really presented in a very different way and is sort of highly interactive, and you're put in a space on purpose where you might feel uncomfortable for whatever reason, I don't like walking into that situation unprepared for that. I think it's really unfair as a performer.
So it has to be really clearly flagged, this is interactive, you will be expected to communicate,
yeah,
to touch,
right,
things, do things.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that is, I think performers and artists are responsible to do that.
My understanding of ethics is about that relationship between how much information you give to audience members, how you preface the experience of an artwork in such a way where they are fully aware of the potential pitfalls and dangers and obscenities that might unfold in the art experience.
Mm.
And this is where, for me, this is the crucial issue, is that sense of consent around the experience of the work. I believe, I would argue, that there is a strong enough history of performance practice dating back to the 60s and even earlier to create a context around which if an audience member comes to see a performance work and they understand it as a performance work, then that gives us license as practitioners to be able to operate within the kinds of parameters of what that work might be, whether it is transgressive, whether it is extreme, whether it is blasphemous, whether it is explicit, whatever. I think the codes of performance art as a language are now ubiquitous enough for an audience to not be able to say, I didn't have a sense that this was going to happen.
Mm. But then you can almost say you're talking about an arts educated audience as well.
I am.
Then so think of something like what you're about to do, Escape,
yeah,
where you're actually accessing an audience who maybe isn't literate in the history of...
I think the work I'm doing in Escape is different because I'm building a new sporting code entirely, and I'm establishing teams to kind of compete against one another, and the terms of engagement are clear because there's rules, and
yeah,
those rules of engagement are set. There's an umpire who determines the rules. There's a certain level of physical risk in the work, but that's quite clearly prefaced. So it's maybe the work I'm doing, Escape, is really different from most of the other work I've done in that the terms of engagement are much more transparent and clear, and I don't think there's any degree of risk in my work that would be in excess of the risk of any sporting activity in terms of injury, particularly in sports like rugby or whatever. So maybe the skate work might be not a good example. Maybe it's better to look back at previous works that have a one-on-one audience relationship where the audience is asked to go through an ordeal of one kind. And I think that's where it's more complicated. You know, I've had people viscerally, violently unhappy about the experience of what they went through, whether they thought it was too difficult, too dangerous, too scary, too complex, too phobic. I have had that kind of response. And I think if I was to take a step back and try and reflect on it, it's like, well, would I do it differently? And does the fact that a certain proportion of people struggle with the fact that the experience is surprising and they didn't expect it and it didn't play out in a way that they anticipated it might have played out, does that does it limit the value, or does it challenge the efficacy of making work like that? And my attitude is no, it doesn't. I think if you make performance work, it is very much about establishing a kind of a critical vocabulary that's about breaking down a distancing effect that the audience might have with artworks. And so I think whilst that's really complex and something that we probably want to unfold in a conversation like this, I would always defend the idea that to somehow explain or give them clear information about what they're about to experience will stone dead kill the experience of the work. So for me as a performer, it's so much about surprise and so much about, I would say as an artist, one of the things that I do is I create architectural spaces and performance spaces that lure people into a scenario.
Because you're kind of asking the person to perform as much as yourself perform.
Definitely. But I'm using structures like inflatable units of one kind, colourful candy, children's recreational structures. I'm using that as a ruse to some degree because people think, great, it's going to be fun, it's going to be an exciting thing. And they don't think critically about what it is they might experience. So when they come in and find out that it's actually not as fun and childlike as they expected, that's when that kind of potential for the hostility, the anger, the uncertainty kicks in. And the whole reason that the works are predicated like that is I'm interested in unfolding a Gordian knot, which can literally, where the work shifts from being one thing to another, it shifts from being pleasurable and childlike to being complex and adult and phobic and challenging, and really challenging cognitively, psychologically and physically. So for me, where I struggle as a practitioner is that I would absolutely defend as a basic necessity that people cannot be informed of exactly what it is they're about to enter into. Mm-hmm. Because to do so would kill the artistic integrity and the experience of the work. But where this comes back to ethics is it ethically problematic to put people in potential spaces of danger and not alert them to the fact that they're about to enter that work? So it's really complex too, because my preference is not to have to say any of the experience of what they're about to entail. But because of the organisations I've worked with in various places in the world, they nearly always say we need a covenant here. Yeah. So people have to read a sheet, which I always find really confusing. It's like, this work requires advanced levels of agility. If you have existing pre-medical conditions, do not enter into this work. You know, so what it does, curiously, is it ramps up the anxiety even more, even though all the organisation's doing is covering its arse to ensure that people can't turn around and say, but you didn't tell me that the work was going to be this or this. Mm. So I think the notion of a disclaimer is also a way in which organisations try and cover their own ethical responsibilities. Or their health and safety responsibilities. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're terrified of the risk. And the interesting thing is that they both want the risk because they like the excitement of work that they might seem to be ambitious or transgressive. But then they hate the risk on another level because it exposes them to the potential for litigation. So for me, that tension is always there. It doesn't matter who you work with, whether it's a public art project in Sydney or whatever, there's always this tension that exists between those things. And I think as artists, we just keep writing that sort of border between the two, trying to figure out how do we negotiate it. And I'm always pushing to create an unmediated experience for the audience, and the organisations are always pushing to mediate it to the point where they feel it's covered themselves in terms of that level of risk. If someone writes a catalogue essay on the project beforehand, or if they require images of the work beforehand, I'm always trying to reveal as little as I can about the scenario of what transpires. I'm just thinking in particular about this work Hole that I did in Melbourne in the Melbourne Festival last year, and it's a really big inflatable structure. And that particular work has quite a level of risk and difficulty and complexity and whatever in terms of how the audience engages with it. And I did it in Sydney at Performance Space and then in Melbourne Festival last year, and it was really interesting just to see the different levels of risk in terms of those two organisations and how they handled it. It got complex in Sydney because a woman broke a leg in the work and they nearly shut it. And this for me was really interesting because there was a whole range of ethics that then came into train. Performance Space nearly shut it down, and they were going to shut it down on the basis that they thought the work wasn't safe. Mm. Whereas what I was saying was, but you knew what the work was, you knew what the risk was, everything was clear before the work began. Why would we close it down now on the basis that someone's hurt themselves? So for me, that's another ethics issue. It became about my ethical rights in terms of the organisation closing the work down. And it was really difficult for a couple of days there. It was very borderline. And interestingly, the board of Performance Space in Sydney said, no, these things happen. Just proceed as you would. Which, of course, is what they should have said. But the director of Performance Space was incredibly uncertain about what to do.
And I think there's also then that question of New South Wales being so litigious.
Incredibly, yeah.
That you know, what kinds of things inflect our understanding of risk. And so the institutional understanding of risk in New South Wales is profoundly more sensitive than in New Zealand, which
is not
litigious.
I did a piece for the City of Sydney the year before in Taylor Square, and I it was with University of New South Wales, curated a project, and I did a kind of big yellow inflatable structure in Taylor Square and plugged it into the water fountain. So when you came down, structure, it was like a slide, which is like a kid's slide, but when you went down it was actually propelling the water from underneath into the structure. So because it's a random water system, you'd either get incredibly wet or you wouldn't, depending on what happened. But it was pitch black by the time you slid in, so you couldn't do anything about it. And about 3 days before the work was about to happen, the city council just said, no, we can't do it, we're going to close it down. And they said we can't guarantee the water quality. And to which I said, but people are drinking this water, dogs drink this water, you've got no signage in the site saying this water is unsafe to drink, but you're not letting me put in an artwork that people would get wet in. And so, again, I was thinking, that's another ethical issue here around a council's responsibility. And what the work ended up doing was highlighting some systemic weaknesses in the way they were dealing with the situation. And so it was easier to get rid of me than to actually address the issue. And even now, I don't think they've put any signage up around the water. So I think, I guess I'm kind of talking around the topic, but for me, there's a sort of series of strata of ethical issues, some of which come back onto me in terms of my relationship with organisation. How do we define this idea of harm? It's like, you know, I have made artworks that people have been harmed in. People have lost teeth, they've dislocated knees, they've broken legs. Does that mean that the artwork is somehow wrong? Is it somehow too dangerous? To which I would say, daily life, sporting activities, everyone's lives, the potential for injury and harm is probably as great, if not greater. And I think that if you're going to make work that requires difficult physical engagement, you're going to have that kind of response. It's always going to happen. And it's not that I value it. I don't relish it. I don't feel good about it.
You don't build your work to...
No, I don't build my work to hurt anybody. I think the structures as they're designed are designed... and they're made, most of my work's made by a company that makes children's bouncy castles. So their whole reason for safety is fundamental because their business is predicated on it. If they design stuff and slides that kids are going to fall over and hurt themselves on, they're going to risk themselves getting exposed. So, I mean, their care and dexterity around risk is really important. So I guess I'm certainly not interested in the physical risk. But sometimes I'm probably more interested in the psychological risk. Those two things I'd like to separate out, but they're not as separated out as they might be. So, and I think it's important that people can back out. They can remove themselves if they don't feel that they want to engage with it. And that's happened many times. Mm. But
in fact, I almost didn't stand on your hands at the PQ11.
You really, but you did, right?
I did. Yeah. I was the first person over.
Oh, there you go.
And I got there and I was like, this is a bit higher than I thought it was.
Yeah. See, that's another example. That works quite a good example in a way, in the sense that I don't think anyone got injured in that work. That might be one of the very few works I've ever made where no one got injured. But the propensity to get injured was massive. If they didn't fall properly or if they tried something stupid. I mean, somebody did come down hands first. And so when I moved it, they went straight down and pretty much landed on their head. I would never suggest that that's a viable way of doing the work. But on another level, if they choose to engage with the work and choose to put themselves in that space, do I as the artist or does my support team say, no, you can't do that, there is too great a sense of risk? That's a really complex issue. Mm-hmm. It's like, because I'm not in a position to make that call. So I've got proxies working for me who suddenly having to make decisions around how engage with the work or what you can and cannot do. And if it was like a kids' circus sideshow or whatever, they wouldn't have been able to do it. It would be like, no, you must do this. You must ride in the ride this way. But I don't know, there's still part of me, which is probably wrong, that thinks if someone wants to try that out, then, you know, they're fully aware of what they're doing and they're an adult and they make a decision, so be it. If they land on their head, they land on their head. That's complex. Ethically, that's very complex. I don't quite know.
Well, I mean, because it's also that question of what kind of agency is given to the person who engages with the work.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, then comes back to that also, what kind of information is given to the person who engages with the work to make them make an informed decision about how they engage with the work.
Yeah.
There is a sort of circle there.
There definitely is. And each of those things are pivoting on one another, and it's not a neat relationship.
When you're doing it in a very public arena where you have non-art audience, where you have a kind of engagement with people who, some of whom will realise immediately it's art and others who will not immediately realise that, and they are actually the ones I'm interested in. I really like those. That's actually where the excitement is, that you're actually messing with people's perception of life. It's actually really quite, you know, I love that. That's what I want to do. So I'm not going to go up to them and say, actually, this is performance, and you may be harmed by this in some way. So I spend a lot of time. My performances can have a year's preparation before they occur, and some of them have been kind of building over. They're parts of a series. So I've developed strategies around shepherding audience members through either my physical actions or presence, or subtle kind of blocks around where they can and can't go if I perceive that there might be some physical danger to them. Now, my last piece that I did in Wellington, I was throwing small porcelain-like planes with great force into the back of a container, and the concern was that fragments could actually get in somebody's eye, and the audience were invited if they wished to throw them too. So in setting it up, I had to think about the distance these fragments might fly. I might think about how I could ensure that people put on safety glasses if they got any further without it going outside the mode of the performance. Mm. So setting up rituals or placing things obviously, so that people will understand that this is what they're supposed to do, becomes part of the piece. And if it, you know, as a last resort, there's your own intervention as the performer, keeping it within the performance. Mm. And that's around physical harm.
Yeah, there's certain strategies to get the audience that kind of can help shape steer the audience to behave in certain ways. Yeah.
So you can't try and provide a lot of non-verbal cues.
Yeah, and usually it's boundaries just without actually they can see. I'm not trying to take them down in the wrestle and so that they're not going to get hurt. Whereas, the object for the Venice one is so that, well, they can wrestle me down to the ground or push me into the water.
Mm.
So, because of my conditioning and training with working with bodies in things like contact improvisation, which are kind of martial arts based techniques. I don't know if you certain other things related to that. I've kind of, with that, I've tried to develop ways of making boundaries with the audience so that if they don't go full on, I don't go full on. If they go full on, I can step up the gear with that based on how they are. So I try to read the audience. It's not perfect, and I'm hoping, you know, I don't cause any trouble. I did put my own knee out in a performance in Australia last year with wrestling. But it wasn't bad. But so that's one way. Another way is having someone stand by as a safety person to make sure that, you know, them or I don't get hurt. Because I think ethics is not just for them, it's also for me.
Yeah.
With this kind of work. And I did have one guy clobber me with this work in Australia, and he was drunk, and he was a big, big guy, and he just totally dropped me, and which is fine. But then what he did, he started dry humping me. I know. Well, it was in a kind of set, it was in a gallery context, but there were two nightclubs around the gallery. Yeah. So it was kind of set up like, it's called Oxford Art Factory, and so you'd never know what you were going to get.
Yeah.
And I put it out that, you know, but I mean, that was, yeah, I don't know. You know, it didn't do it for me. But it's kind of funny. Actually, a few Australian guys are like that. It was really strange. So audience behaviour, if they get carried away, is can be an issue, especially if it's in public, not in our context. And I've had that a wee bit, usually not bad.
Well, it's quite different if you've got a leopard in a cage and the leopard escapes. You know, you've got, that's quite different from also from swinging above people's heads or mounting heavy moving equipment above a performance space, above an audience, or taking them on a walk through some perilous terrain with the lights, with no lights or safety ropes. I guess there's so many different levels of thinking about that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the other situation with feeling unsafe in terms of work is where you have concerns about the level of skill that performers have to carry out the performance that they're doing. So I had an example where I went to a fringe show in Sydney, and it was kind of one of those late night anything goes sort of carny kind of circus performance shows, and I had very real concerns in that, like they were sort of using chainsaws. We were all standing around them on the stage, and they were using sort of chainsaws to get the crowd moving and you know, sort of chopping into things like live chainsaws and all of that stuff, and I felt really unsafe. Like, it wasn't to me, they weren't, you know, professional. They were young people sort of trying things out, which is great, but not when there's chainsaws and sharp things, and the audience was too close. I didn't feel that they had taken their responsibilities seriously. They were also drinking on stage, there was all of that stuff going on, so I left that situation. But normally, having said that, you know, normally circus performers, I think, take that responsibility really seriously, because they actually have respect for their own craft and they know how difficult and potentially dangerous it can be. So when you're moving into that sort of territory, potentially with sort of fire and you know, heights and things that can go wrong, normally they're very, very conscientious about that.
Yeah, but yeah, I can think of things where I can feel like I was going, I was slightly in some physical danger there. Like, that object could actually have flown out and hit me or someone, or but I suppose I haven't really done anything after that and talked to that person or talked to those or kind of like tried to maybe just be a bit more wary next time.
Well, I have to say, as a young performance artist, I really didn't care that much whether people got hurt, and it was only when I saw I had a near miss with a fire sculpture where the whole thing nearly toppled over that I actually started thinking about something beyond the art of it and how horrendous that would have been if anybody had been hit by it or been on it when it occurred.
The risk to audience is usually determined what's your public liability, for instance. And in the UK, you used to have to pay for public liability insurance every year to ensure that the, you know, £20 million building that we were performing in wasn't going to be set on fire by the dancers. So it's interesting, you know, and yet performance, that's the paradox, that you know, you want to set the house on fire, metaphorically, as a performer.
Well, sometimes literally.
Sometimes literally, exactly. But, you know, health and safety and common sense would say, actually, it's not a really good idea to actually set the house on fire. In a real sense, what that means.
Well, my concerns are definitely artistic in nature, and I am begrudgingly compelled to do things like have public liability insurance, which, you know, when I had to get that, I just go on a little story. I had to go and get that because of a contract said, oh, you need public liability insurance. I spoke to the insurance broker and said, you know, just, you know, what are you actually selling me? What on earth is this thing? Because it seems like a crock of shit to me. It just doesn't sound like anything real. And his explanation was, well, you know, you're on the street, you're there with your hat in front of the building, and someone throws a match into that hat, the hat catches fire, before you know it, the whole building is on flames. And I just laughed in the face of that guy. I just thought, that's so, all that is to do with property and commercial interests. And actually, the need for public liability in that situation is only about commercial accountability. And that is so stupid, and I want absolutely nothing to do with that. I mean, eventually I did get public liability insurance through somebody else who had a different way of kind of communicating it. but I still know that that's what it is. It's ridiculous. So,
it's about making sure the hospital gets paid.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's stupid.
Yeah.
It's stupid because it's so individual focused. It doesn't, you know, the reason we're called society is because we're social and that we should have social concerns. And so as an artist, I have social concerns. So the ethics I would place on a performance are to do with the emotional well-being of the public.
I mean, that's something I take really seriously because I am inviting people to participate in something that where I've set up some conditions, and those conditions, you know, heard through headphones. I'm actually giving my participants kind of instructions, and they, like in the various iterations of my work, I suppose sometimes they've been more instructive, and sometimes they've been a little bit more elusive or suggestive, so that, you know, perhaps they might do this. Sometimes they've been quite prescriptive, where it's like take 5 steps, you know. So, but at the beginning of the events, I always sort of have a clause, both written on a piece of paper and verbally. I make it really clear that if they feel uncomfortable about anything, that they don't have to do it, or if that feels like that it might bring them harm if they've got injuries or something, which is a really somatic way of kind of approaching, it's how I would approach a somatic class. It's the same kind of responsibility that I would bring actually to my teaching, my body teaching practice. So they don't have to do anything at any time. So there's always an option out. The stakes in my instructions have been pretty low in terms of the risk factor, to the point even that actually in the last work I had I asked them a question about their relationship with people who had been in the war, for example, and if they had a relative that had died in the war, they were to kneel on the ground. But then I said, if you can't kneel or you feel uncomfortable kneeling to the ground, then you can put your hand on the shoulder of someone else who is kneeling. So I'm always kind of going, well, you know, some people have got knee injuries. so it's really, really pr- pretty low risk. But yeah. that is something I would, like if I take the works outside, then that's they're a less controllable environment. So that's something I'd have to be really mindful of. But so far there's really been no risk to my... It's been focused on a really gentle practice. So it's more about inviting them into a way of listening and opening their perceptions to the environment. And so if I'm asking them to do really risky, extreme things, I think they'll start to close... Like my presumption is that they'll go into a different mode, which would be more like I'd think of in a bodily practice, a more like fight or flight mode. And so as soon as you do that, your ability to listen and the way I'm asking them to listen starts to sort of shut down.
I have done a lot of teaching and facilitation of other, you know, people's work and things, so, and producing, so there is a sensitivity and an authority that I do have already, which if I was less experienced, maybe I wouldn't be able to handle or be able to facilitate things if they were going to get out of hand, because there is a certain amount of like containment that does need to happen if it does feel things getting unsafe, whether it's for other people or for myself in the performance. Also having, like, because I was sort of playing, I was training in youth at Youthline last year, so I was sort of playing with this sort of counselling facilitator role as well, which was kind of satirical, but it was also and manipulative again emotionally for people to disclose potentially. But also, I was actually kind of looking after people as well. Like, and so I suppose that's a set of skills in which, sort of, if I felt like someone really was put on the spot and felt really uncomfortable and looked vulnerable, that I would, you know, come and help them out rather than just let them be humiliated. Which is what the reality television kind of version would be.
Yeah,
so that sort of humanity and community sort of thing comes a little bit more back in, and the sensitivity.
So I do a kind of workshops in conjunction with performances, and in that territory, I wouldn't be surprised if someone had, you know, there has been experiences where people are triggered from past memories and stuff, but the intention is to create a container that holds a space where that can be experienced and really kind of examined in a safe way, in order to kind of break down our own belief systems around certain judgments and expectations and judgments of self and judgments of other, and in order to expand the experience of self so that there's less trauma around. I mean, you know, that's the intention, but whether that happens for everyone or not, I don't know. Probably not.
Like, in being facilitator and in this context, sometimes it feels like a form of some sort of healer, because people, you don't know what people were going to come in. Once you start doing things, then that sort of opens the way for other people to do or say what they want, and that might be quite uncomfortable for them. And they think they can do something, and they come out and they realise that actually they feel really uncomfortable. So being, like, for me to just be there with them, like, being okay with whatever they say or do, and that there's no judgement really. Well, for me anyway, you know, I mean, the audience can think and say whatever they want, but, you know, like, for example, someone coming and lying down with me when asked to come and lie with me in the space, who just completely freezes because they sort of suddenly realise the implications of what for themselves, and they don't know what to say or do. But just being totally okay with where they're at, and the kind of common feedback I've heard is that because of the humour around the way in which people are asked to engage, that accesses a comfortability for them, And then also there's people, some people like being uncomfortable. They want to feel challenged. And they want, yeah. they like, that's what they're interested in, not knowing what's going to, the unpredictable. Because it is, there is a real element of what else could happen, which is exciting.
The comedy festival's on at the moment, so I've been seeing a lot of comedy, and it's always interesting, I think, watching the audience interaction, because there's a real difference between, good, healthy, positive audience interaction and what's actually kind of exploitative
yeah.
audience interaction. And it's interesting how you see how certain performers are very good at it and certain performers I don't think do a good job of it, because mostly the comedy interaction involves dragging someone up on stage and to a greater or lesser extent not making fun of them but making them look a bit silly. But because it's in the context of comedy and a comedy festival, I mean, we all know that's part of it. It's not like you're dragged up in front of at a symphony concert and the conductor says, right, you play the piano, and then you're made to play the piano and you're not very good and everyone laughs at you. I mean, different context. But having said that, you do notice that I think some performers do it really well and some performers actually don't treat the audience very well, and they kind of just make them look
yeah.
really exploited. They look really bad at the end of it. One of the things I think that works really well is that the performer will get an audience member up on stage. They can do funny things with them. And then I think one of the best things you need to be able to do is at the end of that section, you actually make them turn to face the audience and you get the audience to give them a clap. Because to me, it almost is like a ritualistic kind of element to it.
Yeah.
It kind of says, okay, what we've just experienced, audience, it was just part of this false world. And person who I'm holding, up on my stage, face the audience, that it was part of this kind of false world, this premise that we've
yeah.
set up. So we all acknowledge that by doing the kind of ritualistic performer stands in front, audience claps, and then you send them back down to your seat. And I think that provides a really nice kind of break to the humiliation, if you like. But it's when you see performers who do things like, they push people off stage, all right, get off! I think that's an example of just not treating the audience with respect. Because you should always make the person come away looking good. And you can look good after being made to look silly because it's in the context of a comedy, but it's about how the performer treats that audience member. And yeah, so I think there's definitely some ethics that some performers don't display